What happens when a nation forgets its past and starts just doing whatever feels good? Cities crumble, heroes emerge, enemies close in, and the people, time and time again, cry out for help. This isn't some made-up fairy tale. This is war, betrayal, vengeance, miracles. It's the real-deal story of warriors with flaws, women who are fearless, and a God who refuses to give up on his people. From dudes who slay lions to women who take out enemies with tent pegs, from vows that get twisted to a woman who crushes a king with a millstone, this is the wildest, darkest, most profoundly human book you'll find in the Bible. This is the book of Judges, but like you've never experienced it before. After Joshua died, the fearless leader who guided the Israelites into the promised land, an unsettling silence fell over the people. No Moses, no Joshua, just a ton of questions. Who was going to lead them now? They looked around at the mountains, the valleys, the cities still controlled by their enemies. They had the land, sure, but not all of it. The battles weren't over. So they did the only thing they could think to do. They prayed. Lord, they asked, who should go first to fight the Canaanites? And God answered, Judah should go first. I have given them this land. Simple, direct, divine. The warriors of Judah then turned to the tribe of Simeon and said, fight with us. Help us take what's ours, and when it's your turn, we'll fight for you. That's what brotherhood looked like back then. So they teamed up, and their first challenge came at a place called Bezek, where they faced a king named Adoni-Bezek, a seasoned warrior, brutal and feared. But the hand of God was with Judah. They crushed his forces. They captured him. And in an act that was both shocking and symbolic, they cut off his thumbs and big toes. Barbaric? Maybe. But listen to what the king confessed as he bled. I did this to 70 kings, he said. I cut off their thumbs and toes, and now God has paid me back. They brought him to Jerusalem. He died there without his crown, without his power. Judah's army pushed on, marching into hills and deserts. Everywhere they went, the Lord was with them. But not every battle was winnable. When they faced enemies with iron chariots, armored machines of war, they faltered. Even Judah, as bold as they were, couldn't overcome that. Still, God was moving. Somewhere else, an old warrior was ready to make one last mark. Caleb. Yes, that Caleb, the one who spied out the land back in Moses' day, stood tall. He made an offer. Whoever takes the city of Kiriath Sefer can marry my daughter, Aksa. A challenge and a reward all in one. And a young man named Othniel stepped forward. He was Caleb's nephew, but he didn't rely on his family name. He relied on courage. He fought, he won, and he earned Aksa's hand. She was no ordinary bride. She was bold. Ask my father for land with water, she told him. And Caleb gave it to her, both the upper and lower springs. It wasn't just land. It was life. The tribes moved forward. Judah and Simeon together conquered a city called Zephath, burned it down, and renamed it Hormah. Destruction. A warning carved in fire and ash. But not all the tribes followed through. Benjamin couldn't drive out the Jebusites in Jerusalem. So instead of defeating them, they lived alongside them. Joseph's people spied on a city called Bethel. They found a man, made him a deal. Show us the way in and we won't kill you. He helped them. They spared him. He moved on and built a new city elsewhere, called it Luz. Mercy, maybe? Or maybe a sign they were starting to compromise. Tribe after tribe followed a similar path. Manasseh, Ephraim, Zebulun, Asher, Naphtali. None of them cleared the land fully. They let Canaanites live among them. Some even forced them into labor, a shortcut to power, a strategy not blessed by God. And the tribe of Dan? They tried, but the Amorites were too strong. They pushed Dan back up into the hills. The valleys, the fertile places, were lost. Only when the tribe of Joseph grew stronger did they force the Amorites into servitude. A late victory, but not the full obedience God had called for. And so the stage was set. A scattered people, half victories, divided loyalties, a land partially claimed but fully dangerous. The Israelites were learning something the hard way. Having a promise doesn't mean you've lived it. God had given them the land. But now came the test. Would they trust him fully, obey without compromise. Would they remember who led them out of Egypt, through the Red Sea, across the Jordan? Or would they start forgetting? That's how the book of Judges begins. Not with a crown, but with a question. Who will lead? When there is no king, before long, something extraordinary happened. Out of the silence, out of the dust of compromise, out of a generation already forgetting their roots, God sent a messenger. An angel of the Lord descended, not to a king, not to a prophet, but to the people themselves. He traveled from Gilgal, that sacred place of memory where Israel had first set foot in the promised land, where stones had been stacked in remembrance. Step by step, the angel walked until he reached a small town called Bochim. There he stood and then he spoke. His voice cut through the air like lightning in a still sky. I brought you up out of Egypt. I led you into the land I promised your ancestors. I said I will never break my covenant with you. The people stopped, stunned, silent. I told you, do not make covenants with the people of this land. Break down their altars. But you have not obeyed me. The silence deepened. The angel's voice cracked, not in weakness, but in sorrow. What is this you have done? He wasn't asking because he didn't know. He was asking so they would hear it in their own souls. So now I say, I will not drive them out before you. They will become traps for you. Their gods will become snares. The words fell like thunder. A covenant had been broken, not by God, but by his people, and the consequences would not be delayed. Suddenly, something strange happened. Something raw, something deeply human. The Israelites lifted their voices and wept. Right there, in the presence of divine disappointment, they cried out with the grief of a guilty heart. They named the place Bochim, the Weepers, and there they offered sacrifices to the Lord, not out of habit, not out of obligation, but out of mourning, out of brokenness, out of a desire to return. But would it last? Because soon after, the cycle would begin again. Joshua, faithful leader, warrior of promise, had died. He was buried in the hills of Timnath-Heres, a resting place among the inheritance he helped secure. With him passed a generation that had seen God move, had walked through parting waters, had tasted the victory of walls falling at a shout. But the next generation, they did not know the Lord. They had not seen the Red Sea split in two. They had not seen the sun stand still over Gibeon. They had not stood trembling at Mount Sinai. And so they began to forget. They forgot the power of the one who brought them out of Egypt. They forgot the mercy that rained down manna. They forgot the justice that burned against Pharaoh. And into that forgetting crept idols. Baal, Ashtoreth, foreign names with tempting promises. The people bowed to carved wood and stone, to gods that had eyes but could not see, ears but could not hear, mouths but could not speak. The Lord saw and he was angry. These people, he said, have turned away. They follow false gods. They break my covenant. So he withdrew his hand. No more easy victories. No more guaranteed triumphs. Now, when they went to war, they fell. When they cried for help, silence echoed back. But even in judgment, God's mercy flickered like a flame, refusing to die. He raised up judges, not kings, not rulers in golden robes, but humble, flawed men and women who carried the Spirit of the Lord. These judges rose up. They fought. They delivered. And for a time, the people followed God. But as soon as the judge died, the people slid right back into sin, worse sin, deeper rebellion. It was a cycle, devastating, maddening, tragic. Obedience, forgetting. Idolatry, defeat, crying out, salvation, peace, then forgetting again. The Lord watched. He knew their hearts. And he spoke again. Because this nation has violated my covenant, I will no longer drive out the nations Joshua left. I will use them to test Israel to see if they will walk in my ways. So the Canaanites remained, the Philistines, the Sidonians, the Amorites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, not because God was weak, but because his people were. They had failed the test and the world would press in closer. The promised land was filled, but not free. God's people lived among enemies. Enemies they were supposed to drive out. Enemies who whispered with foreign tongues. enemies who bowed to carved gods, enemies who waited. And the Israelites began to change. They didn't just live alongside the nations. They married into them. They gave their daughters to pagan sons, took foreign brides for themselves. And with those unions came something far worse than shared homes or customs. They began to worship false gods. The children of the God of Abraham were now kneeling to Baal, burning incense to Ashtoreth, building altars to lies. So the Lord, whose heart burned with justice and jealousy for his people, allowed consequence to come. From the east came a king, Cushan-Rishathaim of Mesopotamia. His name meant double wickedness, and he lived up to every letter. He crossed borders, took cities, dominated tribes, and for 8 long years, Israel served him, not as allies, not as neighbors, as slaves. God's people, once free, now lived under a cruel and foreign hand. But suffering has a strange way of stirring memory. And the people remembered. They remembered Egypt and how God set them free. They remembered the Red Sea and how it parted. They remembered their covenant. And from that place of pain, they did what desperate people do. They cried out not to Baal, not to Ashtoreth. They cried out to the Lord. And God, merciful even when wronged, heard. He raised up a man, not a prophet, not a prince, a warrior. His name was Othniel. The same Othniel who had taken Kiriath-Sepher. The same Othniel who had won the heart of Oxa. The same Othniel who had once been hungry for a challenge. Now, filled with the Spirit of the Lord, he rose to become Israel's first judge. He didn't come with chariots. He didn't come with clever words. He came with fire in his bones and the hand of God on his back. Othniel led the people. He rallied the tribes. He stood against Cushan-Rishathaim, the double wicked king. And he fought, not with fear, not with compromise, but with faith. And God gave him victory. Othniel struck down the enemy. He shattered their grip. And Israel was free again. Peace swept over the land like a fresh wind. Not for a day, not for a season, for 40 years. A generation grew up under Othniel's leadership, safe, strong, and faithful. And then he died, quietly, without drama, without a throne. Just a man who obeyed God and gave his people peace. But peace is fragile when memory fades. And without Othniel to lead them, the Israelites began to forget again. Forget who freed them. Forget who blessed them. Forget who they were. Othniel was gone. And with him, the discipline, the vision, the spiritual spine of the people. Israel fell again, like a house without a foundation. They did what was evil in God's sight, not out of ignorance, out of habit, out of choice, out of rebellion. So the Lord gave them over to a new king from an old enemy, Eglon, the king of Moab, a man of appetite. He allied with the Ammonites and Amalekites. Together they struck like a storm. They crossed the Jordan. They took the city of palm trees, Jericho, the very first place Israel had conquered, now lost. And for 18 long years, Israel served Eglon, a man whose throne groaned under the weight of his indulgence. A man whose stomach grew while Israel's spirit shrank, until again the people remembered. Again they cried out. Again mercy answered. This time God raised up a man named Ehud, from the tribe of Benjamin, a name. That means, son of the right hand. But Ehud was left-handed. That detail mattered because the enemy would never expect what came next. Ehud fashioned a dagger, a short sword perfect for concealment. He strapped it to his right thigh under his clothes, a place no soldier would check. And then he joined a delegation sent to bring tribute to King Eglon. Coins, goods, offerings of forced loyalty. They bowed. They presented the treasure. And then Ehud turned to leave. But just outside the palace, he paused, turned back, and said to the guards, "I have a secret message for the king, a whisper of mystery." Eglon, curious, arrogant, and unaware, dismissed his guards. Now it was just Ehud and the king alone. Ehud leaned in. "I have a message from God for you." And as Eglon stood, his wide frame rising from the throne, Ehud reached, not to the left, to the right, to the hidden dagger on his thigh. He drove it deep into Eglon's belly, so deep that the fat closed over the blade, so deep that the handle disappeared. Eglon fell dead. Ehud calmly locked the doors and walked away. Later, the guards returned. The doors were still locked. They waited, assumed he was relieving himself. They laughed. They whispered. They delayed, until finally, they opened the door and found their king lifeless. Too late. Ehud had escaped. He made it to the mountains of Ephraim, and there he blew a trumpet. The sound echoed like thunder down the hills. The people gathered. Their fear turned to fire. Their shame turned to courage. Ehud raised his voice and shouted, "Follow me, for the Lord has given Moab into our hands." And they did. They struck down 10,000 Moabite soldiers, strong, seasoned, ruthless men. Not one escaped. Not one. That day, Moab was defeated. And once again, the land had peace. This time for 80 years. 80 years of peace. That's a long time to forget. But forget they did. The Israelites once again turned away from God, and he gave them into the hands of Jabin, king of Canaan. Jabin ruled from Hazor, a fortified city in the north. His general, Sisera, commanded 900 iron chariots. They weren't just machines of war. They were symbols of dominance. Every time Israel tried to rise, those chariots rolled in, crushing hope, burning fields, scattering courage. For 20 years, Sisera oppressed God's people. 20 years of fear. 20 years of silence. Until the cries began again. This time God didn't raise a warrior. He raised a woman. Her name was Deborah. She was a prophetess, a judge, a voice of God in a time of noise. She didn't sit in a palace. She sat beneath a palm tree between Ramah and Bethel, an open courtroom where people came with disputes and left with wisdom. She was respected. She was trusted. She was fearless. And one day, she sent for a man named Barak, a warrior, capable, strong, but hesitant. Deborah looked him in the eye. "God commands you, take 10,000 men from Naphtali and Zebulun. Go to Mount Tabor. There, Sisera will come to meet you, and the Lord will give him into your hands." Barak didn't say no, but he didn't say yes either. Instead, he said, "I'll go if you come with me." Deborah didn't flinch. "I will go. But because you ask this, the honor will not be yours. The Lord will hand Sisera over to a woman." And so the two marched. Mount Tabor stood tall, a lonely hill rising above the Jezreel Valley. Barak's 10,000 men climbed it. From the valley below, Sisera's chariots thundered forward, iron wheels glinting in the sun. Then Deborah gave the signal. "Go. This is the day the Lord gives Sisera into your hands. The Lord goes before you." Barak and his army charged down the mountain. But they weren't alone. Something unseen moved with them. God sent a storm. Rain poured from the sky. Mud swallowed the wheels of Sisera's chariots. His machines of war turned to useless wreckage. Confusion erupted among his troops, and they were struck down. Every single one, except Sisera. He fled on foot, running through the fields, past the trees, heart pounding in panic. He ran until he saw a tent. It belonged to Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Her people were at peace with Jabin, or so Sisera thought. Jael stepped out. Her voice was kind, her eyes calm. "Come in, my lord. Don't be afraid." He entered the tent. She covered him with a blanket. "I'm thirsty," he whispered. She gave him milk. He relaxed. "Stand at the door," he muttered, eyes closing. "If anyone comes, say I'm not here." And he slept. The mighty general, the iron chariot master, the terror of Israel, asleep. Jael moved silently. She took a tent peg in one hand and a hammer in the other. She knelt beside him, raised her arm, and drove the spike through his temple. He never woke. When Barak arrived, breathless and searching, Jael stepped out. "Come, I'll show you the man you're looking for." And there he was, dead. The enemy was defeated by two women, one with wisdom, one with boldness. And that day, God gave Israel victory over Jabin, king of Canaan. And slowly, his grip on the land faded until he was no more. Not every victory ends with a battle cry. Some end with a song. After Sisera fell, after Jael's tent peg silenced Canaan's greatest threat, after peace returned to the land, Deborah didn't just move on. She sang. With Barak at her side, she lifted her voice, not to glorify herself or even her warriors, but to glorify the Lord. And what a song it was. A song of memory. A song of warning. A song of worship. When the princes of Israel take the lead, when the people willingly offer themselves, praise the Lord. Deborah remembered the fear. She remembered how the roads were empty, how travelers avoided the highways, how village life had ceased in Israel, until she arose. Until I, Deborah, arose a mother in Israel. Not a general, not a queen, a mother. Because what she fought for wasn't land or glory. It was future, safety, faithfulness. God chose new leaders when war came to the gates. But not a shield or spear could be found among 40,000 in Israel. That's how low they had sunk. No weapons, no confidence, just hiding in fear. But some stood up. Deborah praised them by name. From Ephraim came those whose root is in Amalek. Benjamin followed you among the troops. From Machir marched down commanders. From Zebulun came those who bear the officer's staff. She honored the tribes who came forward, and she called out those who didn't. Why did Reuben stay among the sheepfolds? Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan. And Dan, why did he linger with the ships? Asher remained by the coast. In the face of danger, they stayed home. And yet others rose. The people of Zebulun risked their very lives. So did Naphtali on the heights of the field. Then she turned her eyes to the sky. From the heavens the stars fought. From their courses they fought against Sisera. Even creation had joined the battle. The Kishon River swelled with divine flood. Chariots drowned. Panic spread. And Jael. Oh, Jael. Deborah saved her highest praise for the woman with the tent peg. Most blessed of women be Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, most blessed of tent-dwelling women. She gave him milk. She brought him curds in a noble's bowl. She stretched her hand for the tent peg, her right hand for the hammer, and she struck Sisera. At her feet he sank, he fell. Where he sank, there he fell, dead. But even in triumph, Deborah did not forget the pain of war. She imagined Sisera's mother. Through the window peered Sisera's mother. She cried out, "Why is his chariot so long in coming?" She waited, but he would not return. And finally, Deborah sang the ending that echoed into eternity. So may all your enemies perish, Lord, but may all who love you be like the sun when it rises in its strength. And then the land had peace for 40 years, not because of kings, not because of armies, because of one woman who listened to God and another who acted in courage. The land had peace until it didn't. 40 years passed after Deborah's song, and once again, Israel forgot. They did evil. They turned from God, and the Lord handed them over, this time to the Midianites. And they weren't just conquerors. They were devourers. Every year at harvest time, they came like locusts, riders on camels, thieves in waves. They didn't just attack cities. They swept through the land, stealing crops, slaughtering sheep, taking donkeys, and leaving behind nothing. Just empty fields, bare trees, starving people hiding in caves and mountain cliffs. For 7 years, this happened. 7 years of watching enemies grow fat on your labor. 7 years of silence from heaven. 7 years of fear until once more the people cried out. And God answered, but not the way they expected. Not with an army, not with a king, with a whisper to a man named Gideon. He wasn't leading warriors. He wasn't standing tall. He was hiding in a winepress, threshing wheat in secret, trying to survive. That's where the angel of the Lord appeared, right there in the fear, in the dust, in the shadows. The angel looked at Gideon and said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." "Mighty warrior?" Gideon looked around. "Me? If the Lord is with us," he replied, "then why has all this happened? Where are the miracles we were told about? Did God not bring us out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us." The angel didn't debate. He didn't argue. He gave a command. "Go in the strength you have. I am sending you to save Israel." But Gideon wasn't convinced. "My clan is the weakest," he said, "and I am the least in my family." Still the voice replied, "I will be with you. You will strike down the Midianites as if they were one man." Gideon wanted proof, so he prepared a meal, meat and bread, and placed it on a rock. The angel touched it with his staff. Fire flared up from the stone, consuming the food in an instant. Then the angel disappeared, and Gideon fell to the ground. "I have seen the Lord face to face," but God spoke again. "Peace. Do not be afraid. You will not die." So Gideon built an altar and called it Jehovah Shalom. The Lord is peace. That night, God gave him his first mission. "Tear down your father's altar to Baal. Cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Then build a proper altar to me." And Gideon offered a sacrifice, and he did it at night because bravery often starts small. The next morning, the town awoke to a shocking discovery. Baal's altar had been destroyed, the Asherah pole cut down, and a new altar built in its place. The people were enraged. "Who did this?" they demanded. They soon found out. "Bring Gideon out," they shouted. "He must die." But then Gideon's father, Josh, the very man who had built that altar to Baal, suddenly found his voice. "Let Baal defend himself," he declared, "if he truly is a god." And the crowd backed down. From that day forward, Gideon was known as Jerubbaal, meaning "let Baal contend." But this was only the beginning. Soon, the valley of Jezreel was overflowing with enemy armies. Midianites, Amalekites, and others too numerous to count. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. He blew a trumpet, summoning the tribes, and they answered his call. Still, Gideon remained uncertain. He asked for a sign. "If you will save Israel by my hand," he prayed, "let the fleece I place on the ground be wet with dew, while the surrounding ground remains dry." The next morning it was exactly as he had requested. Still, he felt unsure, so he asked for another sign. "This time," he prayed, "let the fleece be dry and the ground be wet." Again, God answered. The ground was soaked and the fleece was dry. Now, the man who had been hiding in the winepress was ready, not because he was inherently brave, but because he believed. The valley below was a sea of enemies: Midianites, Amalekites, nomads from the east. Their camels blanketed the land like sand on the seashore. Gideon stood above it all, trembling. Thousands of Israelites had responded to his call. 32,000 men stood behind him. But God had something different in mind. "You have too many men," the Lord said. "Too many. If you win with this army, Israel will boast, 'We did this ourselves.' I won't allow that to happen." So God gave Gideon a test. "Tell the people," he instructed, "anyone who is afraid, go home." And 22,000 men left just like that. Now only 10,000 remained. Still too many. "Take them to the water," God said. "I will test them there." So Gideon watched. Some men dropped to their knees and drank with their faces in the stream. Others scooped the water into their hands, lapping it like alert dogs. God said, "Set apart the ones who drink from their hands." That group numbered 300. 300 men against an army beyond counting. God smiled. "With these 300, I will save Israel." The rest went home. That night, Gideon still wrestled with fear, so God gave him a gift. "If you're afraid," he said, "go down to the enemy camp. Listen to what they say." So Gideon crept down with his servant Pura, past the tents, past the camels, until they overheard two soldiers talking. One shared a dream. "I saw a loaf of barley bread tumble into our camp. It hit a tent and knocked it flat." The other man's face went pale. "That's the sword of Gideon," he said. "God has given us into his hands." Gideon's heart leaped. He didn't run back. He worshipped right there on enemy soil. He knelt in the dust and whispered thanks to the God who had orchestrated all of this. Then, he returned to his men and gave them a plan that no general would dare suggest. "Take a trumpet," he instructed. "Take a clay jar. Hide a torch inside. Follow me. 3 companies of 100 men each. No swords drawn. No surprise attack, just sound, fire, and faith. In the middle of the night, they surrounded the camp. Gideon gave the signal. Now, they blew the trumpets, they shattered the jars, they raised the torches, and together they shouted, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon!" The valley erupted in chaos. The enemy woke in terror. They saw flames. They heard shouts. They turned on each other, striking wildly. Screams echoed into the night. Horses fled. Camels scattered. Soldiers ran blindly through the hills. Israel had no weapons in hand, but the enemy was already defeated. Those who escaped were chased. Men from Naphtali, Asher, and Ephraim joined the pursuit. Two enemy princes, Oreb and Zeb, were captured and killed at places that would forever bear their names. And as the dust settled, Gideon's 300 stood tall, not because of strength, not because of strategy, but because they trusted a God who wins battles with broken jars and courage, because they obeyed when it made no sense. Because sometimes faith isn't about bigger armies. It's about believing a whisper in the dark more than what your eyes see in the light. The battlefield was quiet now. The camels were gone. The tents torn down. The valley that once echoed with hooves and shouts now lay still. Gideon's name was on every tongue. People whispered it like a legend, sang it like a psalm. The man who tore down idols. The man who fought with 300 men. The man who watched God break an army. But the war wasn't over yet. Two kings, Zeba and Zalmunna, had escaped with what was left of Midian's army, and Gideon wasn't done. With his 300, he gave chase across the Jordan. Exhausted, hungry, driven, they came to a town called Succoth. Gideon asked the leaders, "Give us bread. My men are tired, but we're still pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna." But the leaders sneered, "Do you already have the kings in your hands? Why should we risk feeding you?" Gideon's face hardened. "When the Lord gives me those kings," he vowed, "I'll come back, and I'll punish you with thorns from the desert." Then he went to another town, Penuel. Same request, same rejection. "When I return," he warned, "I'll tear down your tower." And still he pressed on, across the wilderness, over the hills until he found the kings. Midian's army, still shaken, still afraid, was caught by surprise. And Gideon captured them. Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of cruelty, killers of his people. He turned back. He returned to Succoth. And he brought proof. "Here they are," he said. "The men you mocked me for chasing." Then, he took the leaders of the town and taught them a lesson they would never forget. He whipped them with desert thorns. He tore down the tower in Penuel, justice harsh and swift. Then he turned to the kings. "What were the men like?" he asked. "The ones you killed at Tabor?" The kings looked him in the eye. "They looked like you," they replied. "Like sons of a king." Gideon's voice cracked. "They were my brothers, my mother's sons. If you had spared them, I'd spare you." He turned to his young son. "Kill them." But the boy was afraid. So, Gideon stepped forward, and with one stroke he ended them. The land was safe. The enemy's gone. And then the people came. "Rule over us," they said. "You, your son, and your grandson. You saved us." It was his moment. The crown was within reach. But Gideon said something no warlord would ever say. "I will not rule over you. My son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." He refused the throne. He walked away from the crown. But he made one request. "Each of you give me one gold earring from your share of the plunder." And they did. Gold piled high over 17 kilograms. From that, Gideon made an ephod, a sacred vest like the one priests wore. He placed it in his hometown in Ophrah. It was meant to honor God, but it became something else. People came to worship it. They bowed before it. And it became a snare not just for them, but for Gideon and his family. He had many wives, 70 sons, and even a son from a concubine in Shechem named Abimelech. He lived out his days in peace. The Midianites never rose again. Gideon, also called Jerubbaal, died old and honored. But after he died, the people turned away again. They chased after Baals. They forgot the Lord. They forgot Gideon. they forgot everything. Because sometimes the final test isn't about what you fight on the outside. It's what you carry inside. After Gideon's death, the land was at peace. But peace, when not guarded, becomes fragile. Abimelech, Gideon's son by a concubine from Shechem, harbored ambition. Not content with being one among many, he sought to be the one above all. He approached his mother's kin in Shechem. "Which would you prefer?" he asked. "To be ruled by 70 sons of Gideon, or by one man, your own flesh and blood?" The people of Shechem, swayed by kinship and ambition, chose Abimelech. They gave him 70 silver shekels from the temple of Baal-berith. With this, Abimelech hired reckless men, mercenaries without conscience. He went to Ophrah, his father's town, and murdered his 70 brothers on one stone. Only Jotham, the youngest, escaped. Abimelech was then made king beside the great tree at the pillar in Shechem. But Jotham, from Mount Gerizim, cried out a parable. The trees sought a king. They asked the olive tree, the fig tree, and the vine, but all declined. Then they asked the thorn bush, which accepted, saying, "Take refuge in my shade, or fire will come from me." Jotham warned, "If you have acted honorably, may you rejoice in Abimelech. But if not, may fire come from Abimelech to consume you, and fire from you to consume him." Then Jotham fled. Abimelech ruled Israel for 3 years, but God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem. They turned against him. Gaal, son of Ebed, moved into Shechem and challenged Abimelech's authority. Zebul, the city's governor and Abimelech's ally, sent word to Abimelech. Abimelech set an ambush. As Gaal stood at the city gate, Abimelech's men attacked. Gaal was driven out. The next day, people went into the fields. Abimelech divided his men into 3 companies and attacked. He captured the city, killed its people, and sowed it with salt. The leaders of Shechem took refuge in the tower of El-Berith. Abimelech gathered wood, piled it against the tower, and set it ablaze, killing about 1,000 men and women. Then Abimelech went to Thebes. The people there fled to a strong tower. As Abimelech approached to burn it, a woman dropped an upper millstone on his head, cracking his skull. He called to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and kill me, so they can't say a woman killed me." So his servant ran him through and he died. Thus, God repaid Abimelech for the evil he had done to his father by murdering his 70 brothers. God also made the people of Shechem pay for their wickedness. After the fires of Abimelech's cruelty died out, after the blood dried in Shechem streets, Israel needed healing. Not a warrior king, not a man of vengeance, just a leader who could restore some peace. That man was Tola, from the tribe of Issachar. He lived in the hill country of Ephraim in a town called Shemir. He wasn't flashy. He didn't conquer nations or tear down idols with fire. He judged Israel for 23 years. He led quietly with justice, with steadiness. Sometimes, God doesn't bring change with a trumpet, but with a whisper that holds firm. When Tola died, he was buried in Shemir. And then came Jair the Gileadite. His name meant he shines. He had 30 sons, each one riding on a donkey, each one ruling over a town in Gilead. 30 sons, 30 towns. They called the region Havoth Jair, which means villages of Jair. Jair judged Israel for 22 years. He too wasn't known for grand battles, but he stood in the gap. He led while others forgot how. He held Israel together just long enough. Then Jair died, and they buried him in Canaan. These two men, Tola and Jair, they weren't like Gideon or Deborah or Samson, but they were God's chosen. Sometimes the mightiest leaders are the ones who simply remain faithful when everyone else forgets. In the rugged lands of Gilead lived a man named Jephthah. Strong, skilled, respected for his bravery, but also an outcast. Why? Because Jephthah was the son of a prostitute. His father, Gilead, had other sons with his wife. And when they grew up, they pushed Jephthah out. "You'll have no share in our inheritance," they said. "You're not really one of us." So Jephthah fled. He settled in a land called Tob. And there, something unexpected happened. Outcasts came to him. Men with no homes, no names, rough men. Fighters. and Jephthah became their leader. He was cast away, but he became a commander. He was shamed, but he became someone you didn't want to cross. Years passed, and then the Ammonites attacked Israel. Their army moved like a thunderstorm gathering on the borders. And suddenly, the leaders of Gilead remembered Jephthah. They came to him in Tob. "Come lead our army," they said. "Fight for us." Jephthah looked them in the eye. "Didn't you hate me? Didn't you drive me away? Now you want me back?" They pleaded. "We need you. And if you come, we'll make you head over all of Gilead." Jephthah agreed, but made them swear before God. And they did. So Jephthah returned. The outcast came home as commander, as judge. But before lifting his sword, Jephthah tried diplomacy. He sent messengers to the king of Ammon. "Why are you attacking us?" The king answered, "Israel took our land when they came from Egypt. Give it back." But Jephthah sent a reply full of history and truth. "We asked to pass peacefully. The other nations blocked us. We didn't take your land. God gave it to us. You've had 300 years to claim it. Now you want it back? I haven't wronged you. You're the one picking this fight." The king ignored him. So the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. He marched through Gilead, through Manasseh, to the border of the Ammonites. But before the battle, Jephthah made a vow, a dangerous one. "Lord, if you give me victory, I'll offer as a sacrifice whatever comes out of my house to greet me first." He fought. He conquered 20 towns. The Ammonites were crushed. Israel was safe. But when Jephthah returned home, the first to run out to greet him was his daughter. His only child, dancing, celebrating, unaware. Jephthah collapsed. "Oh, my daughter. You've broken my heart. I made a vow to the Lord, and I can't take it back." She didn't cry. She didn't beg. She said, "If you made a promise to the Lord, keep it. But give me 2 months to go into the hills and mourn the life I'll never have." He let her go, and when she returned, he kept his vow, a victory wrapped in heartbreak. From then on, every year the young women of Israel would remember her. They would go to the hills and honor her courage. The man they threw away became the man they needed most. But his story is a reminder that words spoken in haste, even in faith, can cost everything. Victory over the Ammonites should have brought peace. But pride always has something to say. After the battle, the tribe of Ephraim, one of Israel's strongest, came storming in. They were furious. They confronted Jephthah, shouting, "Why didn't you call us to fight the Ammonites with you? We're going to burn your house down." Jephthah stood firm. No anger in his voice, just truth. "I did call. You didn't come. So I took a risk. I fought without you, and the Lord gave me victory. Why come at me now?" But the Ephraimites didn't care. They didn't like being left out. They didn't like being outshined. And worst of all, they insulted Jephthah's people, the Gileadites. "You're just runaways from Ephraim," they sneered. "You don't belong to a real tribe." Insults became threats. Words turned to war. Jephthah had no choice. He called his warriors. And a civil battle broke out between brothers. The Gileadites defeated Ephraim's forces. And then they blocked the Jordan River, the escape route home. Every Ephraimite trying to cross was stopped and tested. "Say the word, Shibboleth." But the Ephraimites couldn't pronounce it right. They'd say Sibboleth. A small difference. That meant everything. It revealed who was friend and who was foe. And on that riverbank, 42,000 Ephraimites were killed by their own kin. Not Canaanites, not Philistines, their own people. It was one of the darkest days in Israel's history. When jealousy mattered more than unity. When pride mattered more than truth. When brothers became enemies over words and wounds that never healed. After that, Jephthah judged Israel 6 years more, and then he died. The man who once stood against outsiders had to stand against his own. Not every chapter of history is loud. Not every leader carries a sword. Some simply hold the nation steady when the ground beneath it shakes. After Jephthah's time, Israel was in a fragile place. The people were weary from war, both foreign and civil. What they needed was stability, and God provided. First came Ibzan of Bethlehem. He judged Israel for 7 years. We don't know of any great military victories under his name, but we do know this, he had 30 sons and 30 daughters. He gave his daughters in marriage outside his clan and brought wives from beyond for his sons. Why does that matter? Because it shows wisdom, strategy. Ibzan wasn't building an army. He was building peace, forming alliances, keeping Israel united, one household at a time. When he died, they buried him in Bethlehem. Then came Elon from the tribe of Zebulun. He judged Israel for 10 years, a quiet leader from a quiet tribe. No battles, no monuments, just 10 years of calm. Sometimes, peace is the greatest victory of all. After Elon came Abdon, son of Hillel from the town of Pirathon. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons, and they rode on 70 donkeys, a symbol of wealth and nobility in ancient times. Abdon judged Israel for 8 years. His leadership, like the donkeys his sons rode, was steady, practical, rooted. He wasn't flashy, but he kept the peace. And sometimes, keeping the peace in a nation always on the edge of rebellion is the hardest job of all. When Abdon died, he was buried in Pirathon. Three judges, three quiet chapters, no thrones, no swords, just men who filled the space between chaos and order. Long enough for the next hero to rise. Israel sinned again and again. God handed them over, this time to the Philistines. For 40 years, they ruled over Israel, oppressing, humiliating, and growing bolder by the day. But God had a plan. Not through an army, not through a king, but through a baby. In the hill country of Dan, there lived a man named Manoah. His wife could not have children until one day an angel of the Lord appeared to her. "You're going to have a son," the angel said. "He must be set apart from birth. No wine, no unclean food, no razor on his head. He will begin to save Israel from the Philistines." The woman ran to tell her husband, and Manoah prayed, "Lord, let this man return and teach us how to raise the child." The angel came again, and when Manoah tried to offer him food, the angel said, "Offer it to the Lord." And as the fire rose, the angel of the Lord ascended in the flames. Manoah fell to the ground in fear. "We've seen God. We're going to die." But his wife, wise, calm, replied, "If the Lord wanted us dead, he wouldn't have accepted our offering." Later, she gave birth to a boy. They named him Samson. And the Spirit of the Lord began to stir within him. A Nazarite from birth, chosen, anointed, set apart. But Samson's strength would always be in tension with his weakness, his calling at war with his desires. And that war was just beginning. Samson grew strong, not just in muscle, but in confidence. Maybe too much. One day he went down to Timnah, a Philistine city, and there he saw her, a Philistine woman, beautiful, captivating, and completely forbidden. He ran home and told his parents, "I saw a woman in Tim. She's the one. Get her for me." His parents were stunned. "Can't you marry someone from our people? Not a Philistine." But Samson insisted. "She's the one." They didn't realize this desire, this reckless, impulsive choice, was part of God's plan to confront the Philistines. So they went to arrange the marriage. On the way, Samson walked through a vineyard. Suddenly, roar! A young lion leaped out at him. And in a flash, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Samson. With his bare hands, he tore the lion apart like it was a young goat. He didn't tell his parents. Days later, passing the same spot, he saw the lion's carcass, and inside it, bees and honey. Samson scooped some out. He ate it and gave some to his parents without saying where it came from. The wedding feast came, and with it, a challenge. Samson stood before 30 Philistine men and made a wager. "Let me tell you a riddle. If you solve it in 7 days, I'll give you 30 sets of clothes. If you can't, you give me 30. They agreed, and he gave the riddle. Out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. They puzzled. They debated. They couldn't solve it, so they cheated. They went to Samson's new wife and threatened her. "Trick him, or we'll burn you and your father's house down." Day after day, she wept, begged, nagged, and on the 7th day he gave in. She ran straight to the Philistines, and they answered the riddle. "What's sweeter than honey?" What's stronger than a lion? Samson's eyes narrowed. He knew. If you hadn't plowed with my heifer, you wouldn't know my riddle. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him again. He stormed into another Philistine town, killed 30 men, took their clothes, and gave them to the wedding guests. Then he left, angry, betrayed, humiliated, and his wife. The Philistines gave her to his best man. This wasn't just heartbreak. It was the spark. The war had begun. Some wounds cut deeper than blades. When Samson returned to Timnah, heart still bruised, anger still simmering, he brought a peace offering, a young goat. He said, "I want to go see my wife," but her father stopped him. "I thought you hated her. I gave her to your best man, but her younger sister is prettier. You can marry her instead." Samson's jaw clenched, the pain ignited into fury. "This time, I can't be blamed for what I do to the Philistines," and he vanished into the hills. What he did next, no one saw coming. Samson caught 300 foxes. He tied them together in pairs, tail to tail, and between each pair, he tied a burning torch. Then, he let them loose in the Philistine fields. The flames raced across the grain, the vineyards, the olive groves. Everything burned. It was an inferno of revenge. The Philistines were stunned. "Who did this?" Someone whispered the name, "Samson," because they gave his wife away. So, the Philistines did what cruel men always do. They blamed the woman. They blamed her family. They burned her and her father alive. And when Samson heard that, he didn't cry. He didn't run. He said, "If that's what you've done, I won't stop until I get revenge." And he struck again, fierce, relentless, slaughtering many. Afterward, he disappeared into a cave in the rock of Etam. But the Philistines weren't done. They invaded Judah looking for him. The men of Judah, his own people, came to the cave. "Why are you doing this?" they asked. Samson answered, "I only did to them what they did to me." The Judahites begged, "We have to turn you over. The Philistines rule over us." Samson said, "Swear to me that you won't kill me yourselves." So they tied him with new ropes, strong, unbreakable, and brought him to the Philistines. As he approached, the Philistines shouted with joy. But the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and the ropes fell from his arms like burned thread. He grabbed the first weapon he could find, a donkey's jawbone, and with it he struck down 1,000 men. Breathless, standing over a sea of enemies, he said, "With a donkey's jawbone, I made them into heaps. With a donkey's jawbone, I killed 1,000 men." Then he dropped it and called the place Ramoth-Lehi, Jawbone Hill. But even heroes get thirsty. Samson cried out, "Lord, you gave me this victory, and now I'm going to die of thirst." God split open a hollow place in the ground. Water gushed out. Samson drank and was revived. He named it En-Hakkor, the spring of the caller. And from that moment, Samson judged Israel for 20 years. A warrior, a rebel, a storm with skin. But still, a man chosen by God. Samson, the strongest man in Israel. But he had a weakness. Not for battle, for beauty. One day, he traveled to Gaza, deep in Philistine territory. There, he spent the night with a woman. The Philistines heard, and they set a trap. "At dawn, we strike." They sealed the gates, surrounded the city. But Samson woke at midnight, and instead of sneaking out, he walked to the city gates. Two towering doors of iron and stone. He tore them from their hinges, locks and all. Hoisted them on his shoulders and carried them to the top of a hill facing Hebron. He wasn't just escaping. He was sending a message. "You can't trap me, but even giants can fall." And for Samson, her name was Delilah. She lived in the valley of Sorek. And once again he fell. The Philistine rulers saw their chance. They came to her with a promise. "Find out the secret of his strength. How can he be bound? We'll each give you 1,100 silver coins." And Delilah smiled. She didn't have to fight. She just had to ask. "Samson, what makes you so strong? How could someone tie you up and make you weak?" He played with her. "Tie me with 7 fresh bowstrings. I'll be as weak as anyone." That night, while he slept, she did. And when the Philistines burst in, she cried, "Samson!" The Philistines are here. He snapped the bowstrings like burned thread. And Delilah pouted. You lied to me. Tell me the truth. He grinned. Ropes. That would work. She tried again. Same result. Weave my hair into a loom. She did. He broke free again. But Delilah wasn't done. Day after day, she begged, pleaded, cried until Samson was tired to death. And finally he gave her his heart, his truth. I've been a Nazarite since birth. If my hair is shaved, I will lose my strength, and I will be like any other man. She knew he was serious, so she sent word. Come. He told me everything. That night, she lulled him to sleep on her lap. And as he slept, she shaved off his 7 locks of hair. Then she whispered, Samson, the Philistines are here. He woke up, ready to fight. I'll break free like before. But he didn't know. The Lord had left him. They grabbed him, blinded him, bound him in bronze chains, and threw him into prison. The mighty judge of Israel was now grinding grain in the dark. But in that silence, a miracle was growing. His hair began to grow back. Samson, once feared by armies, was now a trophy. Blind, bound, forgotten. The Philistines couldn't contain their joy. The mighty Samson brought low. So they threw a feast in the temple of their god, Dagon. Thousands gathered, rulers, nobles, spectators. They drank. They cheered. And then someone shouted, Bring out Samson. Let him entertain us. So they brought him. The man who once tore lions apart, now stumbling, guided by a servant boy. They mocked him, laughed at him, and paraded him through the crowd like a prize. Then Samson whispered to the boy, Put my hands on the pillars. I need to rest. He was led to the 2 central columns, the ones holding up the whole building. And there, in that place of humiliation, he prayed, not loud, not proud, just real. Lord God, remember me. Strengthen me once more. Let me just this once avenge my eyes. And with both hands he reached, he braced, he pushed. Let me die with the Philistines. The pillars groaned. The ceiling cracked. The temple collapsed. Stone and fire and screams filled the air. Samson's final act was his most powerful. He killed more in his death than he ever had in life. And under the rubble, his enemies were gone. So was he. Later, his brothers came. They found his body, and they buried him in the tomb of his father, Manoah. And the man they buried had judged Israel for 20 years. A story of strength, a story of weakness, a story of failure and grace. Because even in his brokenness, God used him. And sometimes God's greatest victories are born from our lowest places. In the hill country of Ephraim lived a man named Micah. One day he confessed to his mother, The 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, I have them. His mother responded, Blessed be my son by the Lord. She then dedicated the silver to the Lord, instructing that a portion be used to make a carved image and a metal idol. So Micah took the silver, and from it, an idol was fashioned. He set up a shrine in his house, made an ephod and household gods, and ordained one of his sons as priest. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. A young Levite from Bethlehem in Judah was traveling, seeking a place to stay. He came to Micah's house. Micah said, Stay with me. Be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your living. The Levite agreed. Micah consecrated him, and the young man became his priest. Micah said, Now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as priest. But this was not the worship God had commanded. It was a man-made religion blending truth with error. In those days, the tribe of Dan was seeking territory to settle. They sent 5 men to explore the land. These men came to Micah's house and recognized the voice of the young Levite. They asked him, Who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? He told them about his arrangement with Micah. The men asked, Please inquire of God to learn whether our journey will be successful. The priest replied, Go in peace. The journey you are taking is under the Lord's eye. The men continued and found the city of Laish, a quiet and unsuspecting people. They returned to their tribe and said, "Let's attack them. The land is good, and God has given it into our hands." So 600 Danite warriors set out. When they reached Micah's house, the five men who had spied out the land said, "Do you know that in these houses there are an ephod, household gods, a carved image, and a cast idol? Now you know what to do." They entered Micah's house, took the carved image, the ephod, the household gods, and the cast idol. The priest asked, "What are you doing?" They answered, "Be quiet. Come with us. Be a father and a priest to us. Isn't it better to serve a tribe and clan in Israel as priest rather than just one man's household?" The priest was glad. He took the ephod, the household gods, and the carved image and went with the people. Micah discovered the theft. He gathered his neighbors and pursued the Danites. He called out, "You took my gods that I made and my priest and went away. What do I have left?" The Danites replied, "Don't argue with us, or some hot-tempered men will attack you, and you will lose your life." Micah saw they were too strong for him. He turned back and went home. The Danites took what Micah had made and the priest who had belonged to him and went to Laish. They attacked the city, put the people to the sword, and burned it down. They rebuilt the city and settled there, naming it Dan. They set up the carved image. And Jonathan, son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons were priests for the tribe of Dan until the time of the captivity of the land. They continued to use the idol Micah had made all the time the house of God was in Shiloh. This is a story of stolen religion, of personal worship replacing divine command, of a tribe choosing convenience over covenant, and of a nation doing what was right in their own eyes. There was a Levite living in the remote hills of Ephraim. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah, but she was unfaithful. She left him and returned to her father's house. After 4 months, he went to win her back. Her father welcomed him with open arms and begged him to stay longer. They ate, they laughed, they delayed. But on the fifth day, the Levite said, "We must leave." So they set out in the evening. It was late, and when they reached the city of Gibeah in the territory of Benjamin, they needed a place to stay. No one took them in until an old man came from the fields. "Come with me," he said. "Don't spend the night in the square." They went into his home. They ate and rested. But as night fell, evil arrived. Wicked men surrounded the house. They banged on the door. "Bring out the man. We want to abuse him." The old man begged, "Don't do this wicked thing. He is my guest." Then in horror, he offered them his own daughter and the Levite's concubine, and the men took the concubine. They abused her all night. When the sun rose, she collapsed at the door of the house. When the Levite opened the door, he found her lying there. He said, "Get up, let's go." But there was no answer. She was gone. He carried her body home, and then, in shock and grief, he did something unthinkable. He took a knife and cut her into 12 pieces. He sent a piece to each tribe of Israel. The message was clear. "Look what has been done in Israel." The tribes gathered. 400,000 soldiers stood before the Lord. They heard the Levite story, and they were enraged. They sent word to Benjamin, "Give up the men of Gibeah who did this. Let us purge the evil." But the tribe of Benjamin refused. Instead, they prepared for war. And so brother stood against brother. Israel marched out and the war began. Day 1, Benjamin struck down 22,000 Israelites. Day 2, 18,000 more fell. But on the third day, Israel set a trap. They burned the city. They surrounded Benjamin's warriors, and 25,000 Benjamites were slaughtered. Only 600 survived, hiding in the wilderness. Then Israel turned on the towns of Benjamin, burning, killing, erasing. After the bloodshed, sorrow came. The tribes gathered and wept before the Lord. "One tribe is nearly gone. What have we done?" They had made a vow. "No daughter of ours will marry a Benjamite." But now they needed to save the remnant. They found one town, Jabesh-Gilead, who hadn't joined the assembly. They attacked it, killed everyone except 400 young women. These became wives for the 600 Benjamite survivors. But it wasn't enough. So they made a plan. "During the festival in Shiloh, the girls will dance in the vineyards. let the Benjamites hide. And when the girls come out, each man take a wife. And that's what they did. The Benjamites took wives, rebuilt their towns, and returned to their land. And the book of Judges ends with a single sentence. A sentence that explains everything. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. The book of Judges is not just history. It's a mirror, a window into a nation's soul. What began with Joshua's faithfulness ended in chaos. They had the land. They had the law. They had the stories of miracles and deliverance. But they lacked one thing, a heart that remembered. We watch them win battles, then fall to idols, cry out to God, then forget him again. Each judge brought hope, Othniel, Ehud, Deborah, Gideon, Jephthah, Samson. But each story showed the same cycle. Disobedience, disaster, desperation, deliverance, then disobedience again. It never broke. The cycle just spiraled deeper. They didn't just need a deliverer. They needed a king. Not just someone to save them from enemies, but to lead their hearts. Not just a warrior, but a shepherd. One who could break the cycle for good. And centuries later, that king would come, born not in power, but in a stable. He would ride not on a chariot, but on a donkey. He would wear not gold, but a crown of thorns. And he would defeat not just nations, but sin and death and hell itself. His name was Jesus, the true and final judge, the king they longed for, the king we still need. The book of Judges ends in darkness. But it points to the light, a people lost, a God who never gave up, a story waiting for redemption. And the question is, in a world where everyone does what's right in their own eyes, will you choose the way of the king?